readers, welcome to the Book Report. This is your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're headed across the pond for a look at British books. With the royal wedding being uppermost in most everybody's mind, I couldn't resist. And yes, I have to share, I was there. Okay, not inside Westminster Abbey, but part of the crowd outside who watched and celebrated with William and Kate. What fun! And we're going to have fun this week with a range of titles, some classics newly released with wonderful narrators, and a selection of contemporary titles. So sit back, settle in, and let's listen to some jolly good stuff.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Whether or not you enjoyed reading Shakespeare in high school or college, you might want to take a listen to The Bard again. There are so many wonderful performances available now. You could choose a play you're not familiar with, or one you'd like to return to and explore again. I've selected The Merry Wives of Windsor for us to revisit today. It's a comedy first published by Shakespeare in 1602, though believed to have been written prior to 1597. This is Shakespeare's only play to deal exclusively with contemporary Elizabethan-era English middle-class life. And Shakespeare has a bit of fun with time warp in this comedy, as Sir John Falstaff, who had previously appeared in King Henry IV, set circa 1400, now shows up in this more contemporary setting, circa 1600. It's an enjoyable production by a great cast. Let's listen.
Sir, he's a good dog and a fair dog. Can that be more said? He is good and fair.
Well...
Is Sir John Falstaff here?
Sir, he is within, and I could do a good office between you.
It is spoke as a Christian's ought to speak.
He hath wronged me, Master Page.
Sir, he doth in some sort confess it.
If it be confessed, it is not redressed. Is not that so, Master Page? He hath wronged me, indeed he hath, and a word he hath. Believe me, Robert Shallow, Esquire, Seth, he is wrong.
Here comes Sir John.
Now, Master Shallow, you'll complain of me to the king?
Right. You have beaten my men, killed my deer, and broke open my lodge.
But not kissed your keeper's daughter.
This shall be answered.
I will answer it straight. I've done all this. That is now answered.
The council shall know of this.
'Twere better for you if it were known in council. You'll be laughed at.
Poke of herb, Sir John. Good works.
Good works, good cabbage. Slender, I broke your head. What matter of you against me?
Marry, sirrah, I have matter in my head against you and against your coney-catching rascals, Bardolph, Nim, and Pistol. They carried me to the tavern and made me drunk, and afterwards pick my pocket.
You Bembry cheese!
I eat it no matter.
Oh, no, Mephistopheles!
I eat it no matter.
Slice, I say.
Poker, poker.
Slice, that's my humour.
Where, simple, my man? Can you tell, cousin?
Please, I pray you. Now, let us understand. There is three umpires in this matter. As I understand, that is Master Page, Fidelicet Master Page, and there is myself, Fidelicet myself, and the three party is lastly and finally mine host of the Garter.
We three do hear it and end it between.
Very good. I will make a brief of it in my notebook, and we will afterwards work upon the cause with as great discreetly as we can.
Pistol,
he hears with ear.
The devil understand what phrase is this, he hears with ear. Why, it is affectation.
Pistol, did you pick Master Slender's purse?
Aye, by these gloves did he, or I would I might never come in my own right chamber again else, of 7 groats in mill sixpences and 2 Edward shovel boards that cost me 2 shilling and 2 pence a piece of yeet miller by these gloves.
Is this true, Pistol?
No, it is false if it is a pickpocket.
No, thou mountain foreigner! Sir John and Master Mine, I combat challenge of this Latin Bilbo. Word of denial in thy labyrinth here. Word of denial. Rotten scum thou liest.
Oh, by these lambs, end with
hate. Be advised, sir, and pass good humours. I'll say marry trap with you if they run the Nuthooks humour with me. That's the very note of it.
Oh, by this hat, then he and the red face had it. Though I cannot remember what I did when you made me drunk, yet I'm not altogether an ass.
Well, what say you, Scarlet and John?
Why, sir, for my part, I see the gentleman had drunk himself out of his five senses.
It is his five senses, fie, what the ignorance is.
And being fep, sir, was, as they say, cashiered, and so conclusions passed the conveyors.
Ah, you spake in Latin then, too. Oh, but 'tis no matter. I'll ne'er be drunk whilst I live again, but in honest, civil, godly company for this trick. If I be drunk, I'll be drunk with those that have the fear of God, and not with drunken knaves.
So, God judge me, that is a virtuous mind.
You hear all these matters tonight, gentlemen, you hear it.
Nay, daughter, carry the wine in. We'll drink with it.
Oh, heaven, this is Mistress Anne Page.
How now, Mistress Ford?
Mistress Ford, by my truth, you're very well met. By your leave, good mistress.
Wife, bid these gentlemen welcome.
Oh, you are welcome indeed.
Come, we have a hot venison pasty to dinner. Come, gentlemen, I hope we shall drink down all unkindness.
Come. I'd rather than 40 shillings I have my book of songs and sonnets here. How now, Simple? Where have you been? I must wait to myself, must I?
You've not the Book of Riddles about you, have you?
Book of Riddles? Why, did you not lend it to Alice Shortcake upon All Hallowmas last, a fortnight afore Michaelmas?
Come, cuz, we stay for you. A word with you, cuz, married this cuz. There is, as twere, a tender, a kind of tender made afar off by Sir Hugh here. Do you understand me?
Aye, sir, you shall find me reasonable. If it be so, I shall do that is reason.
Nay, but understand.
Oh, so I do, sir.
Give ear to his motions, Master Slender. I will description the matter to you, if you be capacity of it.
Nay, I will do as my cousin Shallow says. I pray you pardon me. He's a justice of peace in his country, simple though I stand here.
But that is not the question. The question is concerning your marriage.
Aye, there's the point, sir.
Marry, is it the very point of it? To Mistress Anne Page.
Why, if it be so, I will marry her upon any reasonable demand.
But can you affection the woman? Let us command to know that of your mouth or of your lips, for divers philosophers hold that the lips is parcel of the mouth. Therefore, precisely, can you carry your goodwill to the maid?
Here we are at Heathrow Airport talking to travelers, and I wanted to let you know what was on the number one for fiction here at the bookshop. Number one is one we're very familiar with, Patricia Cornwell, Port Mortuary. Number two, Jackie Collins, Goddess of Vengeance. Number three, Michael Connelly, The Fifth Witness. Number four, Frederick Forsyth, The Cobra. Number five, Jodi Picoult, Sing You Home. Number six, John Grisham, Theodore Boone. Number seven, Howard Jacobson, The Finkler Question. Number eight, Sebastian Faulks, A Week in December. Number nine, Ian McEwan, Solar. Actually, I was speaking to a British reader, and they weren't crazy about that book, although they love his other work. And number 10, Mohsin Hamid, Moth Smoke. So that's the fiction chart. Over here at nonfiction, we have No Angel, The Secret Life of Bernie Ecclestone. Number two, Michael McIntyre, Life and Laughing, My Story. Number three, Alex's Adventure in Numberland, which is interesting. Dispatches from the Wonderful World of Mathematics by Alex Bellos. Number four, No Way Down, Life and Death on K2 by Graham Bowley. I'd love to read that one. Number five, Alan Sugar, What You See is What You Get, my autobiography. Number six, Gangland by Tony Thompson, Drugs, Guns, and Murder. Number seven, Sugar Daddy Diaries by Helen Croydon. Number eight, The Rules of Life. Number nine, The Hair with Amber Eyes, A Hidden Inheritance by Edmund DeWall. And number 10, Googled, The End of the World as We Know It by Ken Aletta. So in the fiction works, we have a lot of similar stuff that we're familiar with, but the nonfiction seems really a bit different than what we're used to in the States.
Thank you.
While we're delving into British classics, let's preview The Canterville Ghost by Oscar Wilde. It's an amusing chronicle of the tribulations of the ghost of Canterville Chase, when its ancestral halls become the home of an American, Hiram B. Otis, the minister to the court of St. James. Deftly contrasting the conventional Gothic ghost story with the pragmatism of the modern world, Wilde creates a satire of American materialism, a lampoon of traditional British values, and an amusing twist on the traditional Gothic horror tale. This one's narrated by David Barnes.
And at the close of the season, the minister and his family went down to Canterville Chase. Mrs. Otis, who, as Miss Lucretia R. Tappan of West 53rd Street, had been a celebrated New York belle, was now a very handsome, middle-aged woman with fine eyes and a superb profile. Many American ladies, on leaving their native land, adopt an appearance of chronic ill health under the impression that it is a form of European refinement. But Mrs. Otis had never fallen into this error. She had a magnificent constitution and a really wonderful amount of animal spirits. Indeed, in many respects, she was quite English, and was an excellent example of the fact that we have really everything in common with America nowadays, except, of course, language. Her eldest son, christened Washington by his parents, in a moment of patriotism, which he never ceased to regret, was a fair-haired, rather good-looking young man, who had qualified himself for American diplomacy by leading the German at the Newport Casino for three successive seasons, and even in London was well known as an excellent dancer. Gardenias and the peerage were his only weaknesses. Otherwise he was extremely sensible. Miss Virginia E. Otis was a little girl of 15, lithe and lovely as a fawn, with a fine freedom in her large blue eyes. She was a wonderful Amazon, and had once raced old Lord Bilton on her pony twice round the park, winning by a length and a half, just in front of the Achilles statue, to the huge delight of the young Duke of Cheshire, who proposed for her on the spot, and was sent back to Eton that very night by his guardian in floods of tears. After Virginia came the twins, who were usually called the Star and Stripes, as they were always getting swished. They were delightful boys, and with the exception of the worthy minister, the only true republicans of the family. As Canterville Chase is 7 miles from Ascot, the nearest railway station, Mr. Otis had telegraphed for a wagonette to meet them, and they started on their drive in high spirits. It was a lovely July evening, and the air was delicate with the scent of the pine woods. Now and then they heard a wood-pigeon brooding over its own sweet voice, or saw, deep in the rustling fern, the burnished breast of the pheasant. Little squirrels peered at them from the beech-trees as they went by, and the rabbits scudded away through the brushwood and over the mossy knolls, with their white tails in the air. As they entered the avenue of Canterville Chase, however, the sky became suddenly overcast with clouds. A curious stillness seemed to hold the atmosphere. A great flight of rooks passed silently over their heads, and before they reached the house, some big drops of rain had fallen. Standing on the steps to receive them was an old woman, neatly dressed in black silk, with a white cap and apron. This was Mrs. Umney, the housekeeper, whom Mrs. Otis, at Lady Canterville's earnest request, had consented to keep in her former position. She made them each a low curtsey as they alighted, and said in a quaint, old-fashioned manner,
"I bid you welcome to Canterville Chase."
Following her, they passed through the fine Tudor hall into the library, a long, low room, panelled in black oak, at the end of which was a large, stained-glass window. Here they found tea laid out for them, and after taking off their wraps they sat down and began to look around, while Mrs. Umney waited on them. Suddenly Mrs. Otis caught sight of a dull red stain on the floor just by the fireplace, and, quite unconscious of what it really signified, said to Mrs. Umney,
I'm afraid something has been spilt there.
Yes, madam, replied the old housekeeper in a low voice, blood has been spilt on that spot.
How horrid, cried Mrs. Otis. I don't care at all for bloodstains in a sitting room. It must be removed at once.
The old woman smiled and answered in the same low, mysterious voice,
It is the blood of Lady Eleanor de Canterville, who was murdered on that very spot by her own husband, Sir Simon de Canterville, in 1575.
I couldn't resist this newly released classic tale, Oliver Twist. Now here's the twist. The book is read by Gerald Dickens, great-great-grandson of Charles Dickens. Oliver Twist is the second novel by Charles Dickens. We all loved the Broadway play and the movie, right? I have read the book, but years ago. Of course, it's a time-honored story about the orphan, Oliver Twist, who escapes from a workhouse and travels to London, where he meets the renowned Artful Dodger, Fagin, and Bill Sykes. It's likely that Dickens' own early youth as a child laborer contributed to this story's development. This one is all in the family, so here goes.
Among other public buildings in a certain town, which for many reasons it will be prudent to refrain from mentioning, and to which I will assign no fictitious name, there is one anciently common to most towns, great or small, to wit, a workhouse. And in this workhouse was born, on a day and date which I need not trouble myself to repeat, inasmuch as it can be of no possible consequence to the reader in this stage of the business, at all events, the item of mortality whose name is prefixed to the head of this chapter. For a long time after it was ushered into this world of sorrow and trouble by the parish surgeon, it remained a matter of considerable doubt whether the child would survive to bear any name at all, in which case it is somewhat more than probable that these memoirs would never have appeared. Or, if they had, that being comprised within a couple of pages, they would have possessed the inestimable merit of being the most concise and faithful specimen of biography extant in the literature of any age or country. Although I am not disposed to maintain that being born in the workhouse is in itself the most fortunate and enviable circumstance that can possibly befall a human being, I do mean to say that in this particular instance it was the best thing for Oliver Twist that could possibly have occurred. The fact is that there was considerable difficulty in inducing Oliver to take upon himself the office of respiration, a troublesome practice, but one which custom has rendered necessary to our easy existence. And for some time he lay gasping on a little flock mattress, rather unequally poised between this world and the next, the balance being decidedly in favour of the latter. Now, if during this brief period Oliver had been surrounded by careful grandmothers, anxious aunts, experienced nurses, and doctors of profound wisdom, he would most inevitably and indubitably have been killed in no time. There being nobody by, however, but a pauper old woman, who was rendered rather misty by an unwanted allowance of beer, and a parish surgeon, who did such matters by contract, Oliver and nature fought out the point between them. The result was that, after a few struggles, Oliver breathed, sneezed, and proceeded to advertise to the inmates of the workhouse the fact of a new burden having been imposed upon the parish by setting up as loud a cry as could reasonably have been expected from a male infant who had not been possessed of that very useful appendage, a voice, for much longer space of time than 3 minutes and a quarter. As Oliver gave this first proof of the free and proper action of his lungs, the patchwork coverlet, which was carelessly flung over the iron bedstead, rustled. The pale face of a young woman was raised feebly from the pillow, and a faint voice imperfectly articulated the words, "Let me see the child and die." The surgeon had been sitting with his face turned towards the fire, giving the palms of his hands a warm and a rub alternately. As the young woman spoke, he rose, and advancing to the bed's head, said, with more kindness than might have been expected of him, "Oh, you must not talk about dying yet. Oh, bless her dear heart, no, interposed the nurse, hastily depositing in her pocket a green glass bottle, the contents of which she had been tasting in a corner with evident satisfaction.
Oh, Lord, bless her dear heart, when she has lived as long as I have, sir, and had 13 children of her own, and all of them dead except two, and them in the workhouse with me, she'll know better than to talk on in that way, bless her dear heart. Think what it is to be a mother, there's a dear lamb, do.
Apparently, this consolatory perspective of a mother's prospects failed in producing its due effect. The patient shook her head and stretched out her hand towards the child. The surgeon deposited it in her arms. She imprinted her cold, white lips passionately on its forehead, passed her hands over her face, gazed wildly round, shuddered, fell back, and died. They chafed her breast, hands and temples, but the blood had stopped forever. They talked of hope and comfort. They had been strangers too long.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com, magicbuz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
It's no mystery that Agatha Christie kept us all entertained with her very special brand of whodunits. Readers, I thought you'd enjoy this newly released audio title, Curtain, Poirot's Last Case, read by the wonderful Hugh Fraser. The house guests at Stiles seemed perfectly pleasant to Captain Hastings, so he was shocked to learn from Hercule Poirot's declaration that one of them was a five-time murderer. True, the aging detective was crippled with arthritis, but had his deductive instincts finally deserted him? Poirot alone knows he must prevent a sixth murder before the curtain falls.
I saw the advertisement in the paper, and the fancy took me to go once again to the place which first was my home in this country. At my age, one enjoys reliving the past. Then, figure to yourself, I find here a gentleman, a baronet who is a friend of the employer, of your daughter. That phrase, it sounds a little like the French exercise, does it not? Immediately, I conceive a plan. He wishes to induce the Franklins to come here for the summer. I, in my turn, will persuade you, and we shall be all together, en famille. It will be most agreeable. Therefore, mon cher Hastings, dépêchez-vous! Arrive with the utmost celerity. I have commanded for you a room with bath. It is modernized now, you comprehend, the dear old styles. And disputed the price with Mrs. Colonel Luttrell until I have made an arrangement très bon marché. The Franklins and your charming Judith have been here for some days. It is all arranged, so make no histories. A bientôt. Yours always, Hercule Poirot. The prospect was alluring, and I fell in with my old friend's wishes without demur. I had no ties and no settled home. Of my children, one boy was in the Navy, the other married and running the ranch in the Argentine. My daughter Grace was married to a soldier and was at present in India. My remaining child, Judith, was the one whom secretly I had always loved best, although I had never for one moment understood her. A queer, dark, secretive child with a passion for keeping her own counsel, which had sometimes affronted and distressed me. My wife had been more understanding. It was, she assured me, no lack of trust or confidence on Judith's part, but a kind of fierce compulsion. But she, like myself, was sometimes worried about the child. Judith's feelings, she said, were too intense, too concentrated, and her instinctive reserve deprived her of any safety valve. She had queer fits of brooding silence and a fierce, almost bitter power of partisanship. Her brains were the best of the family, and we gladly fell in with her wish for a university education. She had taken her BSc about a year ago, and had then taken the post of secretary to a doctor who was engaged in research work connected with tropical disease. His wife was somewhat of an invalid. I had occasionally had qualms as to whether Judith's absorption in her work and devotion to her employer were not signs that she might be losing her heart. But the businesslike footing of their relationship assured me. Judith was, I believe, fond of me, but she was very undemonstrative by nature, and she was often scornful and impatient of what she called my sentimental and outworn ideas. I was, frankly, a little nervous of my daughter. At this point, my meditations were interrupted by the train drawing up at the station of Stile St. Mary. That, at least, had not changed. Time had passed it by. It was still perched up in the midst of fields, with apparently no reason for existence. As my taxi passed through the village, though, I realized the passage of years. Stile St. Mary was altered out of all recognition. Petrol stations, a cinema, two more inns, and rows of council houses. Presently, we turned in at the gate of Stiles. Here we seemed to recede again from modern times. The park was much as I remembered it, but the drive was badly kept and much overgrown with weeds growing up over the gravel. We turned a corner and came in view of the house. It was unaltered from the outside and badly needed a coat of paint. As on my arrival all those years ago, there was a woman's figure stooping over one of the garden beds. My heart missed a beat. Then the figure straightened up and came towards me, and I laughed at myself. No greater contrast to the robust Evelyn Howard could have been imagined. This was a frail, elderly lady with an abundance of curly white hair, pink cheeks, and a pair of cold, pale blue eyes that were widely at variance with the easy geniality of her manner, which was, frankly, a shade too gushing for my taste. "It'll be Captain Hastings now, won't it?" she demanded. "And me with my hands all over dirt and not able to shake hands. We're delighted to see you here. The amount we've heard about you. I must introduce myself. I'm Mrs. Luttrell. My husband and I bought this place in a fit of madness and have been trying to make a paying concern of it. I never thought the day would come when I'd be a hotel keeper, but I warn you, Captain Hastings, I'm a very businesslike woman."
Let's go a little more contemporary now. Ruth Rendell is widely considered to be crime fiction's reigning queen, with a remarkable career spanning more than 40 years. In Portobello, she delivers a captivating tale that weaves together the troubled lives of several people in the gentrified neighborhood of London's Notting Hill. Walking to the shops one day, 50-year-old Eugene Wren discovers an envelope on the street bulging with cash. A man plagued by a shameful addiction and his own good intentions, Wren hatches a plan to find the money's rightful owner. Instead of going to the police or taking the cash for himself, he prints a notice and posts it around Portobello Road. This ill-conceived act creates a chain of events that links Wren to other characters and the life of his trusting fiancée. The consequences will change them all. Let's listen as Tim Curry narrates. Yes, that is the Tim Curry, Dr. Frankenfurter from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, a movie I've seen more than a dozen times. And you?
You can buy a harp there, or a birdcage, a stuffed bear, or a wedding dress, or the latest bestseller. If you want to eat your lunch in the street, you can buy paella, or pancakes, piping hot from a stall. But no live animals or birds are for sale. Cheap books in excellent condition are on sale in the Oxfam shop. A little way up the road is the Spanish Deli, which sells mysteriously, along with all its groceries, fine earthenware pots and bowls and dishes. There is a mini-market in most of the centipede's legs. And at Portobello Green, a cupboard market, under a peaked tent like a poor man's Sydney Opera House. In Tavistock Road, The house fronts are painted red and green and yellow and grey. The moment you turn out of Pembridge Road, or Westbourne Grove, or Chepstow Villas, and set foot in the market, you feel a touch of excitement, an indrawing of breath, a pinch in the heart, and once you have been, you have to go again. Thousands of visitors wander up and down it on Saturdays. It has caught them in the way a beauty spot can catch you, and it pulls you back. Its thread attaches itself to you, and a twitch on it summons you to return. Quite a long way up the Portobello Road, a glossy arcade now leads visitors into the hinterland. There is a children's clothes shop for the children of the wealthy who go to select private schools. A shop that sells handmade soaps, pink and green and brown and highly scented. Another where you can buy jerseys and T-shirts, but exclusively cashmere. And a place that calls itself a studio, which offers for sale small watercolours and even smaller marble obelisks. It was here, long before the arcade came into being, that Arnold Wren had his gallery. He never called it that, but preferred the humbler designation, shop. Stalls filled the pavement outside, mostly fruit and vegetables up here. When Arnold's son, Eugene, was a little boy, the vegetables and fruit were of a kind that had been sold in English markets for generations. Eugene's grandmother could remember when the first tomato appeared, and he, now a man of 50, saw the first avocado appear on old Mr. Gibson's stall. The boy's mother didn't like the taste. She said she might as well be eating green soap. Arnold sold paintings and prints and small pieces of sculpture. In rooms at the back of the shop, stacks of paintings occupied most of the available space. He made enough money to keep himself, his wife, and his only son in comfort in their unprepossessing but quite comfortable house in Chesterton Road. Then, one day, when the boy was in his teens, his father took his family on holiday to Vienna. There, in an exhibition, Arnold saw paintings by the Swiss symbolist Arnold Böcklin, on loan from various European galleries. The Christian name struck him because it was the same as his own. Arnold Wren never forgot the paintings. They haunted his dreams, and later on he could have described some of Böcklin's works in the greatest detail, entirely from memory. The Isle of the Dead, the frightening self-portrait with the skeleton's hand on Böcklin's shoulder, the centaurs fighting. He had forgotten where most of the paintings in the rooms behind the shop came from. Some had been inherited from his father. Others were sold to him for shillings rather than pounds by people clearing out their attics. There were thousands of attics in old Notting Hill. But looking through the paintings one day, wondering if this one or that one was worth keeping at all, he came upon a picture that reminded him of Vienna. It wasn't at all like the Isle of the Dead or the Centaur at the Forge, but it had the scent of Böcklin about it.
In Changing My Mind, Zadie Smith captures all of the curiosity, intellectual rigor, and sharp humor that has attracted so many readers to her fiction, starting with her wildly popular debut novel, White Teeth, in 2000. This collection of essays is presented in four sections: reading, being, seeing, and feeling. Changing My Mind invites listeners to witness the world from the author's unique vantage point. Smith casts her eye over material both personal and cultural with wonderfully engaging essays on diverse topics that include literature, movies, going to the Oscars, British comedy, family, feminism, even Barack Obama. In her investigation, Smith also reveals much of herself. Her literary criticism shares the wealth of her experiences as a reader and the ways she's been influenced by others, including E.M. Forster, Zora Neale Hurston, and George Eliot. Smith also speaks directly to writers as a craftsman, offering precious practical lessons on process and encouraging readers to attend to the slippery questions of identity, art, love, and vocation. The title is read by the wonderful Barbara Rosenblatt, which will add to your enjoyment.
Now, women forget all those things they don't want to remember, and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. Then they act and do things accordingly. It was an aphorism, yet it had me pinned to the ground, unable to deny its strength. It capitalized time. I was against the capitalization of abstract nouns, but still I found myself melancholy for these nameless men and their inevitable losses. The second part about women struck home. It remains as accurate a description of my mother and me as I have ever read. Then they act and do things accordingly. Well, all right, then. I relaxed in my chair a little and laid down my pencil. I inhaled that book. 3 hours later, I was finished and crying a lot for reasons that both were and were not to do with the tragic finale. I lost many literary battles the day I read Their Eyes Were Watching God. I had to concede that occasionally aphorisms have their power. I had to give up the idea that Keats had a monopoly on the lyrical. She was stretched on her back beneath the pear tree, soaking in the alto chant of the visiting bees, the gold of the sun and the panting breath of the breeze, when the inaudible voice of it all came to her. She saw a dust-nearing bee sink into the sanctum of a bloom, the thousand sister calyxes arch to meet the love embrace, and the ecstatic shiver of the tree from root to tiniest branch, creaming in every blossom and frothing with delight. So this was a marriage. She had been summoned to behold a revelation. Then Janie felt a pain, remorseless sweet, that left her limp and languid. But I still resist limp and languid. I had to admit, that mythic language is startling when it's good. Death, that strange being with the huge square toes who lived way in the west, the great one who lived in the straight house, like a platform without sides to it and without a roof. What need has death for a cover, and what winds can blow against him? My resistance to dialogue, encouraged by Nabokov, whom I idolized, struggled and then tumbled before Hurston's ear for black colloquial speech. In the mouths of unlettered people, she finds the bliss of quotidian metaphor. If God don't think no more about 'em than I do, they's a lost ball in the high grass. Of wisdom lightly worn, to my thinking, mourning oughtn't to last no longer in grief. Her conversations reveal individual personalities, accurately, swiftly, as if they had no author at all. "Where y'all come from in such a big haste?" Lee Coker asked. "Middle Georgie," Starks answered briskly. "Joe Starks is my name, from in and through Georgie." "You and your daughter going to join with us in fellowship?" the other reclining figure asked. "Mighty glad to have you. Hicks is the name. Governor Amos Hicks from Buford, South Carolina. Free, single, disengaged." "My God, I ain't nowhere near old enough to have no grown daughter. This here's my wife." Hicks sank back and lost interest at once. "Where's the mayor?" Starks persisted. "I wants to talk with him." "You's my two previous for that," Coker told him. "Us ain't got none yet." Above all, I had to let go of my objection to the love tribulations of women. The story of Janie's progress through three marriages confronts the reader with the significant idea that the choice one makes between partners, between one man and another, or one woman and another, stretches beyond romance. It is, in the end, the choice between values, possibilities, futures, hopes, arguments, shared concepts that fit the world as you experience it, languages, shared words that fit the world as you believe it to be, and lives. A world you share with Logan Killix is evidently not the same world you would share with Virgil Teacake Woods. In these two discrete worlds, you will not even think the same way.
Popular British author Peter Ackroyd brings new life to an immortal story of love, adventure, chivalry, treachery, and death. In The Death of King Arthur, the legend retains its appeal. Mordred's treason, the knightly exploits of Tristan, Lancelot's fatally divided loyalties, his love for Guinevere, and the quest for the Holy Grail. Now retold by Ackroyd with signature clarity, charm, and truth to the spirit of the text, the result is not only one of the most readable accounts of the Knights of the Round Table, but also one of its most moving. It's read by Stephen Thorne.
It was a desolate region, largely unknown to the rest of the country, where witches and warlocks were reported to have the mastery. Eventually, he came to Castle Terrible, situated beside the confluence of two rivers, and proceeded to lay siege to it for 50 days and 50 nights. Much blood was shed, and many brave men lost their lives in the skirmishes and sallies that sustained the siege. But then Pendragon grew sick. His face was pale, and his eyes large. He could hardly draw breath. His heart was so weak. One of his lords, Ulfius, approached him as he lay sighing upon a bed of silk wrought with jewels in the form of stars.
"Ah, king," he whispered, "you are suffering from some great distemper. Do you know anything that might have caused it?"
"The two greatest enemies of man, wrath and love, are now fighting over me. My wrath for the Duke of Cornwall consumes me. My love for his wife Igraine is destroying me. Where can I turn? To whom should I pray? I know that I will die far from my family in this bitter land of Cornwall."
"There is one person who can save you, sire."
"Who is that?"
"Merlin, the great magician. He is the man who made the Abbey Church of Derby disappear into the earth. He will know how to heal you. He will find a cure."
"Bring him before me. Let him work his magic on my poor bones."
So Ulfius rode out, whispering the name of Merlin under his breath many times. He knew that the magician was aware of the secret life of all things and would know that his name was being murmured in the wind. The birds or the singing grasses would tell him. As Ulfius rode on, he suddenly encountered a beggar standing in the high road. The beggar wore a hood, and his back was turned to the knight. He seemed to be peering at something lying on the ground.
"Move," Ulfius told him. "Get out of my way."
"Do you begrudge a poor man the space of a dusty road?" the beggar replied.
"Move on, or I will cut you with my sword. It is not right for a knight to argue with one such as you."
"Even if I know for whom you seek, even if I know that your name is Ulfius."
"Who are you?"
"I am the one you wish for. I am Merlin."
He put out his hands, palms outward, and his beggar's clothes were transformed into robes of white satin.
"I am the man of magic."
"Well met, then.
Tell Uther Pendragon that I will cure him of his sickness. There is one condition. He must grant me whatever I wish without reluctance or hesitation. If he agrees, then I will fulfill all of his desires."
"I will tell him this as soon as I return to him. I'm sure that he will keep any promise he makes to you."
"Good. The king will gain the object of his desire. I guarantee that. Now, ride back to him. I will not be far behind you. I will never be far away."
In good spirits, Ulfius galloped off and made his way to the king's pavilion, which had been erected in the field in front of Castle Terrible. He walked in and made reverence to Pendragon, who was still lying in his bed, sick at heart.
"I have found Merlin, Lord King."
"Where is he?"
"He said that he will not be long, sir."
Here we will tell of the birth of King Arthur.
There was a sound as of bird wings beating, and at that moment Merlin appeared at the entrance of the pavilion. Suddenly, the Magus was standing at the king's bedside.
"Sir," Merlin said, "I know what is in your heart. I know your secrets. If you will swear to me on the honour of a true and anointed king that you will fulfil my desire, then you will have your wish." "Bring me the holy book," Bendragon asked a courtier. Then he swore his oath upon it. "This is my desire," Merlin said.
Years ago, Moab is My Washpot, Stephen Fry's autobiography of his early years, was published to rave reviews. In the years since, Fry has moved into a completely new stratosphere, both as a public figure and a private man. Now he is not just a multi-award-winning comedian and actor, but also an author and director. He chronicles his life in The Fry Chronicles, an autobiography. Much loved by the public and his peers, Stephen Fry is one of the most influential cultural forces in the country. His memoir promises to be courageously frank, honest, and is read by the author, who has narrated all of the 7 Harry Potter novels. This title details some of the most turbulent and least well-known years of his life, with writing that will make you laugh, move you, inform you, and above all, surprise you.
I really must stop saying sorry. It doesn't make things any better or worse. If only I had it in me to be all fierce, fearless, and forthright instead of forever sprinkling my discourse with pitiful retractions, apologies, and prevarications. It's one of the reasons I could never have been an artist, either of a literary or any other kind. All the true artists I know are uninterested in the opinion of the world and wholly unconcerned with self-explanation. Self-revelation, yes, and often, but never self-explanation. Artists are strong, bloody-minded, difficult, and dangerous. Fate, or laziness, or cowardice, cast me long ago in the role of entertainer. And that is what I found myself throughout my 20s becoming. Though at times a fatally over-earnest, over-appeasing one, which is no kind of entertainer at all, of course. Wanting to be liked is often a very unlikable characteristic. Certainly I don't like it in myself. But then there is a lot in myself that I don't like. 12 years ago, I wrote a memoir of my childhood and adolescence called Moab is My Washpot, a title that confused no one, so clear, direct, and obvious was its meaning and reference. Or perhaps not. The chronology took me up to the time I emerged from prison and managed somehow to get myself accepted into university, which is where this book takes up the story. For the sake of those who have read Moab, I don't mean to go over the same ground. This book picks up the threads and charts the next 8 years of my life. Why so many pages for so few years? It was a late adolescence and early manhood crowded with incident. That is one answer. Another is that in every particular I fail Strunk's Elements of Style or any other manual of good writing. If a thing can be said in 10 words, I may be relied upon to take 100 to say it. I ought to apologize for that. I ought to go back and ruthlessly prune, pare, and extirpate excess growth. But I will not. I like words. Strike that. I love words. And while I am fond of the condensed and economical use of them in poetry, in song lyrics, in Twitter, in good journalism and smart advertising, I love the luxuriant profusion and mad scatter of them too. If my manner of writing is a self-indulgence that has you grinding your teeth, then I'm sorry, but I'm too old a dog to be taught to bark new tunes. I hope you forgive the unedifying sight of my struggle to express some of the truths of my inner self and to measure the distance between the mask of security, ease, confidence, and assurance I wear, so easily that its features often lift into a smirk that looks like complacency and smugness, and the real condition of anxiety, self-doubt, self-disgust, and fear, in which much of my life then and now is lived. It is a life, I suppose, as interesting or as uninteresting as anyone else's. It is mine, and I can do what I like with it, both in the world, in the real plane of facts and objects, and on the page, in the even more real plane of words and subjects. It is not for me to be so cavalier with the lives of others, however. In much of my life, from 1977 to 1987, people appear who are known in the public world and to whom I cannot give convincing pseudonyms. If I told you, for example, that at university I met a man called Liu Horry and that we embarked on a comic career together, it might not take great insight or too much googling on your part to know that I was writing about a real person. It's not for me to go blabbing about his life and loves, personal habits, mannerisms, and modes of behaviour, is it? On the other hand, were I simply to say that everyone I met in my journey through life was darling and gorgeous and super and lovely and talented and dazzling and sweet, you would soon enough be arcing streams of hot vomit all over the place, and in every probability short-circuiting your e-book reader.
Readers, after scanning all of the London papers for royal wedding coverage, what did I come across in the London Times? Listen to this, The Dirty Dozen, the best British sex novels after Lady Chatterley. I just had to share this with you. Number one on the list by Ian McEwan on Chesil Beach. In only 160 pages, McEwan captures the sexual trauma of a whole generation. Proof at last that when it comes to fiction, size doesn't matter. Money by Martin Amis hilariously joins the dots between sex, capitalism, and consumption. Number three on the list, The Crimson Petal and the White by Michael Faber. Michael Faber has produced the novel that Dickens might have written had he been allowed to speak freely. Okay. Number four, The Swimming Pool by Alan Hollinghurst. Set in 1983, the novel charts the sexual aspirations and acts of two gay men during the last good summer in London before AIDS becomes apparent. Number five, Howard Jacobson, The Finkler Question. As a chronicler of what it means to be Jewish in a post-religious, post-postmodern world, Jacobson is peerless. Do you think that bit about foreskin restoration is true? All right, you might want to open the cover of that one. Birdsong by Sebastian Falks. Some X-rated haymaking before the war goes and spoils everything. It's set in 1910. Nick Hornby, High Fidelity. Aimless record shop owner Rob Fleming doesn't do much shagging, but his neurotic musing on its rewards and pitfalls are as mercilessly accurate as you'd expect. Next on the list, The Passion by Jeanette Winterson. Winterson's second novel launched her into the literary stratosphere and made a girl with webbed feet a heroine. Follow Napoleon's army and discover an imagined Venice, its moist lagoon a potent metaphor. Next, Before She Meets Me by Julian Barnes, a deeply creepy study of retroactive sexual jealousy. Next on the list, Trainspotting, I think we've all seen this movie, by Irvin Welsh. Welsh's sensational debut is remembered for its portrayal of heroin use, soiled bedsheets, and a toilet bowl. But where there's drugs, grisly sex follows. From Sarah Walters, Tipping the Velvet. The theme of this novel, set in 19th century, may have surprised Queen Victoria, who allegedly refused to believe that lesbianism existed. And last on the Times, Best British Sex Novel List by Angela Carter, The Bloody Chamber. Carter transforms the fairy tales we thought we knew in her beautiful, bold retellings. Okay, that's the list from London. Go and read some.
Dick Francis, who passed away last year, had an amazing literary career after his amazing career in racing. Did you know that Francis was one of the most successful post-war national hunt jockeys? The winner of over 350 races, he was a champion jockey in 1953-54 and rode for the Queen Mother. On his retirement from the sport, he published his autobiography, The Sport of Queens, before going on to write 41 best-selling novels.
His last four novels, Dead Heat, Silks, Even Money, and Crossfire, were written in collaboration with his younger son, Felix, a former physics teacher, who, over the last 40 years, has helped research many of the Dick Francis novels. In Crossfire, the story begins with Captain Thomas Forsyth's tour of Afghanistan being cut brutally short when he was badly wounded by a roadside bomb. Tom's world is torn apart by the injury. The army had been his life. 6 months of recuperation leave is a daunting prospect, but not as bleak as the probability of never rejoining his regiment. Tom returns to his childhood home in England, where his mother, a famous racehorse trainer, in fact the first lady of racing, is having serious problems. She is being blackmailed and is being forced to make her horses lose. Though his mother had always put the horses first and her children last, Tom sets out to discover and defeat this hidden enemy. It's a gripping title, read by Martin Jarvis.
Progress, seen day by day, had been painfully slow, with painful being the appropriate word. However, I was now able to walk reasonably well on an artificial foot, and whereas I wouldn't be playing football again for a while, if ever, I could climb up and down stairs unaided, and was mostly self-sufficient. I might even have been able to run a few strides to catch that bus, if only I had wanted to go wherever it was bound. I looked around me. No one had turned up to collect me, nor had I expected them to. None of my family actually knew I was being discharged on that particular Saturday morning, and quite likely they would not have turned up, even if they had. I had always preferred to do things for myself, and they knew it. As far as my family was concerned, I was a loner, and happier for it, perhaps the more so after having to rely for months on others for help with my personal and private bodily functions. I wasn't sure who had been the most shocked, my mother or me, when a nurse had asked during one of her rare visits if she could help me get dressed. My mother had last seen me naked when I was about 7, and she was more than a little flustered at the prospect of doing so again 25 years later. She'd suddenly remembered that she was late for an appointment elsewhere, and had rushed away. The memory of her discomfort had kept me smiling for most of the rest of that day, and I hadn't smiled much recently. In truth, 251-98241, Captain Thomas Vincent Forsyth, had not been the most patient of patients. The army had been my life since the night I had left home after another particularly unpleasant but not uncommon argument with my stepfather. I had slept uncomfortably on the steps of the army recruiting office in Oxford, and when the office opened at 9 a.m. the following morning, I had walked in and signed on for Queen and Country as a private soldier in her Grenadier Guards. Guardsman Forsyth had taken to service life like the proverbial duck to water, and had risen through the ranks, first to corporal, then to officer cadet, at the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, followed by a commission back in my old regiment. The army had been much more to me than just a job. It had been my wife, my friend, and my family. It had been all I had known for 15 years, and I loved it. But now it appeared that my army career might be over, blown apart forever by an Afghan IED. Consequently, I had not been a happy bunny during the previous 4 months, and it showed. In fact, I was an angry young man.
Readers, I hope you're as bully for the British titles as I am. Take a look at my website, www.bookreportradio.com, and catch up on past titles you may have missed. There's great fodder there for book club selects. Thanks so much for joining me today. I look forward to being together again next week for The Book Report.